Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the State House Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of March 12th, 2019. Dark money. What is it? Who uses it? And how does it affect how people see issues and candidates? We talk with the Post and Courier's Andy Brown on his in-depth report on the $6 million, of which he could verify, that flowed into and around the 2018 elections in South Carolina, the misleading ads and mailers that money buys, and what state lawmakers want to do to fix it. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who write the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections of our podcast instead of lamenting your lost 1 hour of slumber. And the start of allergy season. Honestly, do normal people have full use of both of their nostrils? Because I don't. I don't think it's even allergy. I mean, it happens year-round. I have questions. Or as you get ready for St. Patrick's Day, y'all see leprechauns say, yeah! Now for a brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reports that following a six-hour debate on March 7th, the South Carolina House passed its major education reform bill by a vote of 113-4. Key parts of the bill will ensure that students can read on grade level by the end of the third grade. It will improve career training access for high schoolers, boost colleges' teacher training programs, eliminate four tests in social studies and science, add a greater ability for the state to turn around failing schools, which has worried some, and it also includes a teacher and student bill of rights, which are basically mission statements. The bill heads to the Senate, where they're also working on their own version of it. Number two, the state newspaper reports that a bill that would have extended voter registration in South Carolina by a few days was scrapped in an unusual move in the House at the behest of the Republican Party Chairman Drew McKissick over fears of voter registration fraud. Now, the State Elections Commission, which is responsible for voter rolls and conducting elections, is in favor of extending the rolls and keeping them open by 25 days before an election, instead of 30 to 31 days. Previously, the House passed the bill by a vote of 70 to 30 during second reading, which usually determines if a bill is going to pass. However, for the third reading vote, which usually mirrors the prior vote, 20 Republicans switched to no, along with 7 who joined them. The bill died 55 to 40. Number 3, boondoggle update. The Post and Courier reports that federal law enforcement is still interested in SCANA, the parent company of SCNG, which is now owned by Dominion Energy. The March 4th hearing focused on whether the company, several of its board members, and its top three executives misled investors in the lead-up to the failure of the $9 billion VC Summer nuclear project in July 2017. Staff members with the U.S. Attorney's Office sat in on a federal court hearing, indicating that a federal criminal investigation remains in progress. Now, the hearing was over a class action lawsuit by SCANA investors who said they were willfully misled by the utility. Number 4, happy budget week! Okay, calm down. It's just in the House. Still have to go to the Senate. Calm down. Lawmakers began debating the budget on Monday this week and will soon vote on the $9 billion budget. So it's definitely something you want to pay attention to this week. And here are a couple highlights that you probably already know about. So far, they put $160 million in for teacher pay raises, raising the salaries for teachers at a minimum of 4%. $2.2 million for 90 additional mental health counselors in schools. $50 million to cover rising healthcare costs for state employees, and $61 million from that Mega Millions jackpot, who that winner came forward, along with $35 million, will help give taxpayers a $50 tax rebate, and much more. You can find out more details about the budget and the inner workings by going to sestatehouse.gov. Click on the tab Committee Postings and Reports, and hit Ways and Means. You can find everything you want there. You can also watch the proceedings online as well. The budget will then head to the Senate Finance Committee, which will craft its version of the budget, which will hit the floor the week of April 15th in the Senate. And just like that Tamagotchi you haven't checked in on since fourth grade, spoiler alert, he's dead. We buried the lead. Yeah, look it up, Generation Z. It's something, oh God. Oh my gosh, my Furby's dead. Oh, my baby. Oh my God. Oh my.
The
The Post and Courier's Andy Brown wants you to know the truth about dark money. But why? He recently wrote an in-depth piece on how outside groups, funded by undisclosed donors, spent at least $6 million to influence South Carolina's 2018 elections. $6 million is what could be verified, meaning more was spent likely. Almost none of these groups were required to file any disclosures with the State Ethics Commission. This is brought to you by Citizen Leaders for Truth, because it's the truth, South Carolina. And if any of that sounds familiar to you, then yes, you've inadvertently interacted with dark money advertising, folks. Hey, Andy, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate the lead-in.
Oh, what? I don't know what that was. I don't know where that came from. Because we have no disclosure, so I have no idea who did that. But we aired it. I don't know why. Happy Sunshine Week. And if you don't know what Sunshine Week, it's an annual initiative to promote open government and push back against excessive government secrecy, obstructionist Freedom of Information Act policies, and more. So what better week to talk about this dark money than during Sunshine Week, Andy? So for people that maybe didn't read your article or don't really understand the ins and outs of campaign finance, can you just tell us about what dark money is, how maybe people have interacted with it, maybe didn't even know what it was when they did?
Yeah. Campaign finance traditionally has been individuals giving money directly to candidates, and then those candidates use those funds to pay for mail or yard signs or television ads. What dark money is, and what this has become, is an outside group. Maybe it's what's called a super PAC at the federal level, or a nonprofit 501c4 registered with the IRS. They will come in and spend millions of dollars at times on independent advertising. They're not supposed to coordinate with the candidate. They're not supposed to essentially orchestrate how this is done, but they can come in and spend unlimited amounts of money on television ads, radio ads, Facebook ads to promote a candidate or tear down one of their opponents. If you were in the South Carolina in 2018, you likely saw these ads. If you're a cable viewer or a broadcast viewer, they're the ads that were very ominous sounding and saying how, you know, Henry was a 30-year politician, Henry McMaster, our governor, or Catherine Templeton, his opponent, had been fired from three different government jobs, very contentious ad. And at the end, if you watch closely, at the very bottom of the ad, it says, paid for by X group. Mm-hmm. And these groups have different names. There's Citizens for a Working America. There was American Future Fund, the Conservative Leadership Alliance, the South Carolinians for Ethical Leadership. All of these groups essentially operated in the dark, meaning you can see that this group spent on it. But whenever you go to track down who their donors are with the federal government or in South Carolina, in some instances with the State Ethics Commission, you can't find a single name of an individual or business who contributed to that account.
But some PACs, I mean, there are some PACs that they do, you know, actually have more disclosure with the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, and you can see the donors. But are you talking about some of these PACs also have like an LLC? So, for example, if I wanted to like shield who I am as a donor, I can create an LLC and then donate to this PAC, and then that PAC can spend that money without having anyone know that, hey, I was one who was, you know, spending money trying to slam somebody.
Yeah, I mean, think of it like a chain, right? What often happens at the federal level is you will have a nonprofit set up as a 501c4, which gets all of these donations from individuals or large corporations. They package them. You can't see who their donors are. So this is all within, you know, behind the scenes. They package all that money, send it on to a super PAC registered with the Federal Election Commission, and then that super PAC then spends the money on the ads. And so if you trace the money back, all you can see is that it came from a nonprofit. You don't know who is behind the nonprofit. You don't know who its top contributors are. You don't know what their interests in getting this certain politician elected.
And that's kind of where a lot of your investigation kind of stopped. I mean, you said you got to $6 million that you could verify, but I mean,
I couldn't track. I think, you know, probably three quarters or so. I'd have to look at the numbers again. But three quarters of that $6 million, you couldn't tell essentially who the donors were behind it. Mm-hmm. And so while everybody, it's funny, you know, as reading through clips from the last election of some of the people who covered the election much more than I did, Henry McMaster got slammed for a couple $1,000 he received from Scana Corporation, the primary contractor at the nuclear project out in Fairfield County, because you could see that they had contributed to Henry directly to him. Nobody made a fuss at all over the millions of dollars he got from these dark money groups. Mm-hmm. So it really is an odd set up where, you know, these politicians are being scrutinized extremely for who gives directly to them. And yet this side operation, this side campaign is happening where donors are giving millions of dollars and you have no idea who is behind it.
You mentioned in your report that McMaster benefited from like, what, $1.7 million from about seven different groups. Five of those were like, it seemed like true dark money groups. The other two was that with the Palmetto PAC and then also the National Governors, Republican Governors Association.
Right. The Republican Governors Association is an organization that you can see who their donors are on the IRS website. They contribute to Republican gubernatorial candidates throughout the country. And they usually come in during the general election essentially to ensure that Republicans control the governor's offices in as many states as possible. Mm-hmm. But the Palmetto PAC is interesting because it was actually a dark money group too if you trace it back far enough. Because almost all of their money came from Citizens for a Working America, which is a nonprofit that contributed $1.1 million to their effort. And so if you trace it back far enough, Palmetto PAC, you can see their donors, but almost all of their donors come from two groups anyway.
So, Andy, is this becoming more and more prevalent? I mean, you're $6 million. I mean, what's the history here in this becoming more of a reality in South Carolina and the country? And then also, I mean, we're looking at 2020. This isn't going to stop anytime soon.
No, I mean, all of this essentially started in 2010, as I explained in my story. There was a string of lawsuits or court cases that happened that ultimately led to this in the country. You had now infamous decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. And in that decision, the five Supreme Court justices, so a split court, decided that unions and corporations, which had been banned from paying directly for these large ad buys in elections, that they were all of a sudden allowed, and it was their constitutional right to spend as much money as they wanted on elections. That opened the door to, you know, what we're seeing today with people masking their spending behind nonprofits and corporations. That same year in 2010, South Carolina got slapped with its own court ruling that essentially gutted the ability of the State Ethics Commission to regulate and to review the campaign accounts of groups that are spending on behalf of state candidates. So governor, legislature, even mayor or city council, or in one case in Charleston last year, school board had these dark money groups come in. And they no longer have to file a scrap of paperwork with the Ethics Commission in South Carolina in order to spend this money. And so I've seen a lot of people respond to my story that South Carolina is the Wild West of dark money and campaign finance, and it kind of is. It's one of only three states in the country that doesn't track any of this third-party spending at all. And so you really, South Carolina is very much in the minority on even the basic disclosure, right? I had to calculate how much was spent by these third-party groups based on advertisement purchases with cable networks and broadcast networks that documentation is collected by the Federal Communication Commission. Mm-hmm. We in South Carolina, meaning we citizens, don't even have the ability to put a price tag on how much these groups are
spending.
Which
is why you're saying $6 million is only just what you could verify, what you could find. That's ad buys.
That's mostly television ads. Yeah. That doesn't take into account mail that was sent out on behalf of these candidates.
Consulting fees, legal fees.
Consulting fees, legal fees, radio ads, more and more online ads. Mm-hmm. So the things that you see pop on your Facebook feed. I suspect that was a very conservative estimate of over $6 million of what was spent in last year's elections.
And Andy, kind of want to move forward a little bit too, just from that election, just looking at the State House, the state its grand jury report that came out with the State House corruption probe, you know, the five-year probe that had a lot of damning things come out of it. But like we were talking about earlier, it doesn't seem like it really registered with a lot of people because we did get some insight into how dark money operations work. We saw in that State House report, the grand jury report, how Richard Quinn and Associates, you know, for example, helped unseat Senate Judiciary Chairman Larry Martin. And it's an interesting tale that you can probably give more details about. But it's just all these things, you know, you look at how it's spent in these big races, you look how it's spent in these smaller races. And at the same time, and then these recommendations from the grand jury, but doesn't seem like much is going on. But they kind of give us that insight about what happened with Larry Martin there in that case.
I mean, that grand jury report really gave us the cause and effect of what dark money does. It showed that Larry Martin, a former senator of 30-something years, I think, had been in the legislature, served there a long time, was the Senate Judiciary Chairman, which, if you don't know and you don't follow the legislature, is a very powerful chairmanship in that body. They get to decide, you know, essentially how a bunch of bills are crafted. And so he gets to 2016 after, ironically, leading a charge on ethics reform in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Martin did a lot to try and change some ethics here in South Carolina and shepherd that bill through the legislature. And then He gets to the spring of 2016, and he starts facing ads in his Republican primary and the runoff that he faced. And so he starts seeing these ads from a group, very innocuous sounding group, something better for our community. I can't remember exact term right now. And he had no idea who this group was. You know, it was registered at a P.O. box up in Easley, where he's from. They were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on television ads and mailers that were essentially attacking Martin and supporting his opponent in the primary runoff. And as a result, you can't give causation. Maybe it was just the voters didn't thought it was Martin's time to leave the legislature. But the ads obviously contributed to him losing the election. And it took another 2 years until last fall that he was finally able to actually get some closure and understand who actually spent that money. Mm-hmm. And, this grand jury investigating corruption in Columbia revealed that it was the Trial Attorneys Association, mm-hmm. which operates under the name South Carolina Association for Justice here in South Carolina. These trial attorneys, according to the report, spent $200,000 or a little more attacking Martin with this money. And they did so by funneling the money through a political consultant, Richard Quinn and Associates, which was essentially shut down by the corruption probe. Mm-hmm. And they created this fake name and this fake persona without ever having to register anything with the State Ethics Commission. Mm-hmm. And attacked Martin.
Yeah, because Martin wanted to put caps on jury payouts in civil lawsuits, which was a big
right. And
issue.
So it was directly, according to the report, it was directly tied to what he was advocating for or opposing in the legislature, mm-hmm. which was the ability of trial attorneys to collect higher damages in civil lawsuits. Which is just, you look at that and you're like, well, as Martin told me in my story, he's like, wouldn't the citizens of his district like to have known that? Yeah. When the election was going on.
Which is what gets back to the whole point of disclosure. I mean, like you're going back to McMaster getting dinged for having scandal money. If you knew where this money was coming from in this advertising, again, it's not tied directly to campaigns because they can't technically be associated with these groups, but you would still want to know which group and who is funding a group that is, say, you know, a proponent for one candidate and who's tearing down another candidate. I mean, that's kind of the basics there.
I go back whenever people ask me about this and, you know, they ask about dark money. I go back to what the Supreme Court ruled in 2010 with Citizens United, right? They opened the floodgates for all of millions and billions of dollars nationally to be spent on these independent ads. At the same time, these conservative justices who ruled this way also said, we expect there to be disclosure. They essentially said, yes, it is the right of these corporations and millionaires and billionaires to spend as much money as they want on these outside ads, but it is also the right of the public to be able to know who is spending that money so that they can make educated decisions about what they're ingesting and the types of ads they're seeing. That hasn't caught up. That hasn't happened. The laws in the country and in South Carolina have not caught up to the point where we are requiring these people who are funding millions of dollars to get a single candidate in some instances elected. The laws have not caught up to make them put their name and attach their name to that money.
Well, and kind of looking forward, I mean, we did, you know, in that state grand jury report, there was a push. There was a good part of it that said, hey, we do need to strengthen our ethics laws. And then you're seeing the same thing, you know, as a result of that. But we're not seeing that actually coming to fruition, which is kind of interesting because it was a 5-year-long corruption probe. You know, there's still some loose threads there. But are we seeing any push in the legislature to do anything to either strengthen the ethics laws? I mean, we did see some changes back in 2016, but I mean, since then it's been kind of,
it's been quiet, right?
But there's some legislation as a result of this. I mean,
yes,
Mandy Powers Norrell's talked about, you know, some legislation.
There's bipartisan lawmakers, you know, who find themselves in the middle often of the political spectrum who want disclosure. They want to require at least these third-party groups that are spending millions on a governor's race or on a state legislative race to have to file at least a report with the State Ethics Commission that claims we've spent this money, here's how much it is. Now, it's going to be tough legally, and they're going to have to craft this bill in a very specific way to ensure that disclosure happens on who the donors are. But even if the legislature passed a bill that would require a dollar figure to be attached to each group that's spending in these elections, that would be an improvement over where we are currently. Mm-hmm. We have no ability to even understand or quantify how much outside funding is going into this type of advertising. And so there's bills that would start to do that. I have not seen them in a committee yet. I have not seen them gain any traction in the legislature as of yet.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, I just don't know what's going to come of it. But
well, and it's the thing too we were talking about. You know, it's people might decry, you know, the state of politics and how things work, but at the same time, they don't maybe think, oh, we should be toughening ethics to help combat this, because no one's really calling up their lawmaker and being like, hey, I want better ethics reform. I mean, that's not top priority for a lot of people, but at the same time, it is the root cause of a lot of issues people have with politics. But I think it's also interesting that in order for anything to be done with ethics, it has to be done, the lawmakers have to do it themselves. And it's
tough
sell if you're a lawmaker.
What's interesting, though, is that you have some of the most powerful lawmakers in the state house who have been targets of this money before. Mm-hmm. Most of the targets of this dark money in South Carolina, I should have pointed this out, was conservatives attacking Republicans in the primaries because they don't like them on their stances. William Timmons was attacked. Lee Bright was attacked. This money is more often in South Carolina directed from conservative groups at Republicans than it is.
The money doesn't discriminate, essentially.
Right. Senator Hugh Leatherman, who up until this year, whenever he kind of ceded a little bit of his power, was essentially the Senate president or Senate pro tem. He was attacked in 2016 with a substantial amount of dark money to the point where in order to compete, he had to expend almost like all of his money from his campaign.
But Nikki Haley did have an advocacy group, and her people were disclosed. But however, that was just one of many. I mean, dark money coming.
Listen,
there's a variety of ways that
there's a variety of ways to do this, and you can be transparent with your donors. Mm-hmm. The point is that in South Carolina, the law does not require it.
Yeah.
And so, if you want to stay secret, you stay secret. There's a ton of ways to set these things up so that if you're someone who wants to give $1 million to get one candidate elected, your name doesn't have to be attached.
Mm-hmm.
And until the legislature, when Congress has a responsibility in this too, until Congress does something as well, this is going to be the new normal.
And I we're kind of wrapped up here. I just want to talk really quickly about that Tom Davis, Senator Tom Davis, Party Boy Tom Davis, the mailer that came out. If you were on Twitter, if you're really into everything that's going on up here, you might have heard about it. It's that mailer. I mean, this is separate. It's kind of like dark money because we don't even know where the hell it came from, but it's also not directly tied to like a campaign per se issue. But there was a mailer that went out last week accusing Tom Davis of like essentially trying to support, you know, recreational marijuana because he's pushing this medicinal marijuana bill through. You know, had a picture of him holding a bag of weed, a very bad Photoshop job. There's a bunch of California girls on like straight house lawn. I mean, having a good time. It sans the, you know, marijuana usage, but I mean, and it just, you know, he got on the Senate floor and kind of, he said, I've been a victim of dark money. I mean, he also had a good sense of humor about it. He's gotten a lot of press off of it. But
I mean, it was dark.
Classic example?
I mean, it was dark money. Now, it's so far out from a legislative race where Senator Davis would be up for re-election, right? That's happening in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that it could be considered electioneering communication, meaning that they're essentially advocating for his defeat in an election. But it definitely had some problems with it, if I'm not mistaken. It didn't even have a disclosure at the bottom of this mailer that said, paid for by X group. Now, that is absolutely required.
So even if we don't know who the donors are, we have to at least know who the group is. But that's where you're saying it might be different because it's not tied directly to the campaign, essentially?
This is very murky.
Yeah.
You get this far out from an election. Essentially, if you're not in a couple-month window of an election, it becomes much more difficult to regulate this type of thing. I don't pretend to understand all of the legal aspects of that. I'll leave that up to the people who study this much more thoroughly than I do. But the point being, somebody paid for this.
Yeah.
And these very, very like heavy, well-made mailers.
AT got one.
And we don't even know the group that is saying they're behind this. And so it's just random stuff that shows up in your mail.
Yeah, you just said the new norm. I mean, that's...
And it's obviously trying to influence something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that something is, whether it's the legislation in the state house that Tom Davis is trying to pass to legalize medical marijuana, or if it's essentially attacking Davis himself over this issue. So again, South Carolina can go nowhere but up at this point because there are literally no rules here on this type of thing. So any type of improvement will increase the transparency in South Carolina.
Yeah, and Lynn Teague with the League of Women Voters tweeted, quote, no disclosure, dark money again. You can say any wretched thing in South Carolina without being held accountable. And if you want better insight into dark money, check out Andy Brown's story on thepostandcourier.com and check out our listener guide for this episode, which has a link to the story and the State House Corruption Grand Jury Report on SCETV.org/SCLEAD or on the Leads page on SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Andy, thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign trail news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. First up, Brady Quirk Garvin announced Friday that he was stepping down after 5 years as the chairman of the Charleston County Democratic Party and is endorsing New Jersey Senator Cory Booker for president. Speaking of 2020, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown said that he is not running for president. Brown announced the news last week, which came a week after he made a swing through several early voting states, including South Carolina. Now, while he was in town, he picked up the endorsement of a prominent Democrat, Florence Mayor Stephen J. Wakila, which is now up for grabs. Wakila previously supported Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in the 2016 race. Now, since we talked about one politician's child running for office, it's only fair that we mention that Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Luke Rankin's son, Luke, was elected University of South Carolina's student body president. He won 53% of the vote in a runoff last week. Looking at Congress, U.S. Representative Joe Cunningham made his thoughts on seismic testing loud and clear Thursday when he blew an air horn to demonstrate, how disruptive seismic blast testing offshore can be. Cunningham is quoted in the Post and Courier as saying that seismic blasts to find oil and gas reserves are 16,000 times louder. Five companies are currently seeking federal permits to conduct seismic testing off South Carolina's coast, with a decision on the permits expected by April. Now, the work sought by the Trump administration is widely opposed on the coast, and the state of South Carolina has also filed an injunction. South Carolina Democratic Party officials have announced that they will hold their annual convention on the weekend of June 22nd in Columbia. Now, no headliners have been announced yet. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Now, did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with more state trivia that you may or may not get? Like me, I haven't gotten many recently. It's been kind of a dry spell. Mm-hmm. It's been dry. But Russ, tell us what you got this week. I'm really excited. It's, you know, spring. It's daylight savings time. Things are changing. Maybe my luck's going to change.
Let's hope so. Well, you know, Congressman James Clyburn announced last week, and didn't really get a whole lot of attention. I think it probably continued to build attention as it goes, that South Carolina is right on the verge and will soon be getting its second national park. You know, those are only authorized by Congress. I think there are only 60 something in the country. So it's a pretty big deal when you get a national park. And the new one that will be coming to South Carolina is really kind of an interesting concept. It's called the Reconstruction Era National Park and Historic Network. And what that is actually will be a network of qualified Reconstruction Era historic sites, such as the Penn Center down on St. Helena Island in Beaufort County, and Camp Saxton at Port Royal, also in Beaufort County. And those will be part of this new historic network national park. It will be maintained local ownership, but managed by the National Park Service. Of course, other entities across the country can participate in that as well if they qualify. But that leads us to our question, since this will be the second national park in South Carolina, what was the first national park in South Carolina?
I mean, as an avid fisherman and outdoorsman, please.
This will come very easily to you.
Of course.
A, Fort Moultrie. B, Fort Sumter. C, Congaree National Park. D, Cowpens National Battlefield.
And you said, I know Sumter's a historic site, but I mean, when you have National Park in your name, or is it Congaree National Forest? Yeah, I mean, you asked if we have what the first national park is in South Carolina.
What was the first national park in South Carolina?
Is it still current?
You're assuming this is going to be kind of tricky, but
is it still the current national park?
No clues.
Oh, see, now that's the thing. Yeah, read it.
Fort Moultrie on Sullivan's Island, Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, Congaree National Park south of Columbia, and the Cowpens National Battlefield between Spartanburg and Gaffney.
See, he wants to say the first one, but if this is only the second one, then that means that it may have lost its designation. But if that one is the National Battlefield, that still has its designation. I mean, it's a park, I guess, right? God, Russ, this is just like, if I don't pick the obvious answer, everyone's like, you didn't pick the obvious answer. This one has a national park in it. I am just like, if I don't have my National Park Service handbook, which I left at home this morning, so I can't consult my timeline. The first one. I'm going to go with C.
With C, Congaree National Park.
I mean, it's like, I have to go with a safe bet here because I don't want to gamble.
Well, the Congaree National Park was the first and only state park in South Carolina.
You see where I'm at, people? Wait, what?
Until the second one comes online.
Good thing you're going to give me it. You see how I live my daily life?
Now, not only does the Reconstruction Era National Park and Historic Network kind of bring the Penn Center and Camp Saxton and sites like that along, is that same bill also upgrades Fort Sumter and Fort Moultrie from national monuments to national parks.
Yeah, that was a very dark money-esque question there, Russ. Very obvious, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, I'm on edge. I'm on edge. Good to be back on the board, and thank you, Russ, for that insightful knowledge.
Can't make them any easier.
I'm literally trying. It's all up from here. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy to use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. You can search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, Spotify, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, where you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Friend us on social media and then send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address and we'll send one right your way. And also, like, friend us too. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on March 11th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. First rule of LeadPod. Tell everyone about LeadPod.